Hello, and welcome to episode 17 of That Yoga Woman's Podcast, a podcast where yogis, yoga teachers, and studio owners share stories of their lives on and off the mat. I'm Jules Buchanan, a yoga teacher and your host. This week, I'm talking to Freddie Sardes. Freddie is the founder of Yogi Freddie, is based in Marlow in Buckinghamshire, and has been teaching yoga for nearly 20 years. In 2000, she travelled to Australia to complete her 500-hour Yoga Alliance course and would describe her style as classical Hatha yoga. Freddie went on to study pregnancy and postnatal yoga, as well as yoga therapy. In 2012 and 2013, she studied with Matthew Sanford, founder of Mind Body Solutions, to learn to teach adaptive yoga. I'm going to let Freddie explain more about what that is during the podcast, but essentially, adaptive yoga are classes for people living with mobility disabilities. On her return to the UK after her first training, she set up the first adaptive yoga classes in the UK and started offering one-to-one sessions for people with different conditions. Often very moving and inspirational, Freddie will talk to us about her experiences during those sessions and the impact of yoga on some of her clients. In 2018, she returned to the US to study adaptive yoga again, but this time training to teach yoga teachers adaptive yoga across the UK and Europe. In collaboration with one of her students and other trainees of Matthew Sanford, Freddie set up Adaptive Yoga UK with the aim of establishing and running adaptive yoga classes and to support the training of adaptive yoga teachers and class assistants in the UK and Europe. So we're going to find out how all of that is going. Like all of us, Freddie is passionate about sharing yoga with everyone, and she's found it an invaluable tool for her own self-care and stability. So we'll be talking more about this and how she's used yoga in her different life stages, from during pregnancy to early menopause. I'm so pleased to introduce Freddie Sardes to That Yoga Woman's Podcast. I hope you enjoy listening to our conversation because I really loved having the conversation with her. So thank you, Freddie, and welcome to That Yoga Woman's Podcast. Freddie, let's start by finding out how this third lockdown has been going for you.
Ooh, good morning, Jules, and thank you for having me. I must admit it's a question that's made me pause in my tracks and reflect more than I've been doing. One thing for sure, even though we've been in and out of different phases of lockdown for a year now, it's not getting easier. I don't find it any easier. And I kind of chuckle to myself about how back in March, so many times I had the conversation with friends and people that, thank God this isn't in the middle of winter. Can you imagine if this was over Christmas in January? Oh my God, we'd die. Well, we're in it. We're in it. So it's tough. It's much harder emotionally, primarily, I would think, but partly because I'm not a winter person. So this is a time of the year where I usually shrink. Yeah, I want to do less. And so this is what's happening. The flip side of it is, in a way, I feel the structure of lockdown is giving me permission to answer. You know, like I've seen many a winter where I've gone, oh my God, I just wish I could hibernate. That's what nature does. This is what I want to do. Well, right now I've got full permission to do it. So I'm very much of the attitude of saying, like, don't do violence to yourself, because the shape of lockdown in my eyes is a very socially violent thing to do. And so I try in each day to bring myself kindness by not judging what the choices that I make.
Yeah, so you're cutting yourself a bit of slack.
Yeah, totally. If I binge on the serpent like I did on the weekend, then that's what I do. Yeah, and I feel like I know myself well enough to know that this isn't me all the time. And yeah, and that when nature changes, when the rhythm of life changes, things will be different. But I feel also incredibly grateful for the small blessings in my life, to live somewhere beautiful, to have a good circle of friends and family support to be living with a teenager who most of the time I like. You know, like the, our home situation is simple. I'm able to carry on working and honoring my bills. And all these right now feel like really important things.
Yeah.
So it's the mix of feeling properly, forgive my language, pissed off, yeah, about what's happening to us as a society. And also going, okay, girl, like I think we've been an incredibly blessed generation of grown-ups that this is the first full-on hardship we're living through. And it's not as, I don't think it is as violent, traumatic as maybe people who've lived through war and or civil war and things like this. So I'm kind of trying to put it into perspective. And but the when I said, you know, I shrink in winter, it's very much, it's like this pulling away from the outside world and going for the simpler things. A lot of cooking at the moment. I come from a family of restaurateurs, so cooking is important to us. And appreciating that I've got the time, that life is slower. That really suits me, the fact that life is slower.
Yeah, it's interesting that, isn't it? We were talking a bit before we came on about I'm teaching less. And I think when I think back to the number of classes I was teaching before, I think that opportunity to really slow down, although it's been kind of foisted upon us, it's definitely something that I'm going to take on board going forwards and make more time for myself, for sure.
Yeah, I really agree. It's if I look at my schedule, I don't know, like 6-7 years ago when Maylis was still in primary school and I moved out of London 10 years ago. I taught for 15 years in London, then decided to move. And the first few years when she was in primary school, most of my work was still in London. Mm. So I would drop her off at school at 9 a.m, get on the motorway to head into London, teach my classes back to back, eat my lunch in 10 minutes in the car. Rush back to primary school to pick her up, take a 5-minute nap in the car so I could cope with the second half of the day. It's like, no, I don't want this at all anymore.
What does a typical day look for you at the moment, Freddie?
Well, I really enjoy, I'm not a morning person naturally whatsoever. It doesn't mean I'm grumpy, but it's more, I find it very easy to go to bed very late and get up late. Okay, so it's more nonsense. Mm. But I like that currently all my classes happen mostly in the morning. So it's giving me that just enough of that structure that I'm not completely in the loose. So I get up about 7:30, I think, most mornings, meditation, breakfast, and then I get ready to teach. And I'll usually teach a mix of group classes and private clients till about noon. And the afternoons are mine. And I do my best to go out for a walk every day. It doesn't always happen. I so chicken away from the cold.
Oh, see, there's only, like, now I've moved up north, it's not the weather that you need to check, it's the clothes. I don't mind being out in the cold if I'm warm enough and I'm toasty enough. So I've got some old ski gloves and I'm wearing those now. So they make my hands look like massive Hulk hands, but I don't care. I just am warm and toasty. That's the most important thing. I go out for a walk every day the same, but I'll make sure I'm warm and toasty. And you said you live with your 15-year-old daughter. How's that homeschooling going?
Well, fingers crossed. So far, I'm lucky. She is a child that homeschooling suits her better.
Wow.
And the shift happened very quickly with the first lockdown. At first, I was keeping an eye on her a lot. And then after a week or so, I asked her a few questions. How was she getting on and everything? And she said to me, Mom, they're giving us so much work that if I fall behind, I'm going to get completely discouraged. So she said, I'm just doing each day, you know, what's the task for the day. It's changed now in the autumn and this current lockdown. They're doing face-to-face classes a lot more. Schools have had a chance to adapt. So, I feel very fortunate. Maze is pretty independent with her learning. But my brother lives with three boys aged 13. Twins are 13 and the younger one is 9. And both him and his wife work from home. And Jesus Christ, it's a very different story. So I have a lot of sympathy for all our friends and family who are dealing with a more complicated set of circumstances.
Is there any advice, not advice, but anything you can recommend to others in your position with a teenager at home?
The key word here is teenager.
Yeah.
So my kid is very interested in psychology. Yeah, that's what she's decided she wants to do for A levels and probably beyond. And she kind of, we often have those discussions where we'll do a little dinner catch up of the gang, you know, like I'll ask, and so how's so and so and so and so and so and so. And what Manis is very perceptive with is sensing, knowing where our friends are at emotionally. And what I'm hearing, Jules, is our teenagers, I think, are really struggling. And that bothers me deeply because I really hope we're not sacrificing them right now. Yeah. Mm. For the greater, for the way we're given the description of the greater good. So with Mayonnaise, I made it clear pretty early on that I feel that our home is a safe bubble for her to have friends over. And that's what we're going with. And so she's got two very close friends that are welcome to come and go as they want. And then a few other satellite friends. And what I'm really putting as a priority for our small family is her emotional well-being. And through giving that priority to her, letting it be a support to the other families around us as well. Just maybe some night at home. It's easier than, and I'm working from home, it's easier than a family where maybe there's also contact with an elderly parent, where there's maybe contact with a vulnerable population and so on. Our life is simpler in that way. So I'm saying, okay, let this be a place where she can get support, other people can get support. But advice, I would say I really think this is a time for each one of us to trust what feels right for their family. All our circumstances are so incredibly different. I don't feel it would be right of me to say, I think this is what should happen.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, I get that. So going back to life before yoga, if there was such a thing. So I've dug around a little bit on you, Freddie, as I normally do. And I have to say, I can only find quite current material. So I'm going to ask the questions. Your French, as your name suggests, your lovely accent. Where did you grow up in France?
I grew up in Brittany. I grew up in a part of the world that has a very similar climate to England. And I laugh at this because I have a sunshine craving personality. So you would think, why? But hey, it'll change. But yeah, I grew up in Brittany. I grew up on the Loire estuary. So it's the south of Brittany between Nantes and Saint-Nazaire.
Okay.
And I grew up in a very small village town, very industrial.
So then after you studied your baccalaureate, I'm going to say that quietly because baccalaureate, you then studied at the University of Nantes. So that was local to you, I understand now. You got a master's in English literature and Spanish. Do you still speak Spanish now? And what do you speak at home? Yeah, okay. Cool. That's great.
Bastante bien en español, creo.
Oh, that's brilliant. So it's totally stuck then. That's great. How do you do you still use it? Because I dabbled a bit in Spanish in the past, but I think if you don't use it, you lose it so quickly. So who do you speak Spanish with? You must speak to someone with it.
It's rare. It's rare. And it's always a pleasure, like any chance that I get, you know. A few years ago, it was better. For 3-4 years, we had a lovely, lovely cleaner who was from Ecuador and who really struggled to learn English. So it was fantastic. Every week I got a chance to chat away with her. Spanish is close to French. It's the same family of languages. So it's a lot easier for me. In theory, it would have been a lot easier for me to be fluent in Spanish than in English.
And what do you dream in?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Because I think that's like your real, like whatever you dream in, that is the essence of you. I don't know whether that's true or not.
Well, all languages are in there. So there's some French, there's some English, there's some Spanish for sure. But there's even languages I don't know. There's been the occasional dream where I wake up and I go, oh my God, like I was speaking fluent German, or, you know. So it's a pretty wide life out there when I'm dreaming. And same if you could say, what do I dream in or what do I think in? It's almost influenced by the context. And I see it at home with my niece. So if I am thinking about things that are related to yoga or related, I could say, to the whole world of well-being, which has been a passion since my early 20s, it's in English, definitely. I haven't got the language in French.
Right.
Yeah, but then something else is going to be in French.
And what about your daughter? People say, don't they, it's easier to learn languages when you're young. Speak French, presumably?
She's beautifully bilingual.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. I mean, fair enough. I'm a language teacher first and foremost. That's what I studied at university. That's what I went on to do afterwards. So it was so clear and easy and simple for me that the moment Mavis was born, I was going to speak French to her. And what I've done since she was tiny is I systematically repeat what she's just said in the correct version if she's made a mistake. And because I always did it, she's never seen it as criticism. She just, you know, it's the way it happens. I mean, I don't think I do it much at all nowadays, but she is, yeah, she switches from one to the other. When we spend a lot of time in France in the summer and the French kids love it because they get her. They call her the English kid, like she's always l'anglaise. But there's no language barrier. And then they'll ask her to speak English and they giggle away because they think, oh my God, what a weird thing she can do. and she's decided to take her Spanish for A-levels and she's got a beautiful, beautiful Spanish pronunciation.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah,
that's nice. So I guess they would know her as the English kid, but know she can speak French so well that if they start to talk about her, then doesn't it? That's shut down straight away. She's on it. So I read that you lectured French in Seattle after university. You lectured French in Seattle in the US, as well as, I don't even know if I can say it, Saskatchewan in Canada. I've been to Canada. And I know that bit in the middle where Saskatchewan is just huge and vast and there's not a lot really there.
Oh my God, yes.
How were those years of teaching for you? What were they like?
I loved it. It was a whole mix of circumstances. I think it's the same in the UK when you do a degree in languages, you're expected at some point to go and live in a country that speaks the language you study. And for me, there were exchanges between the University of Nantes and Saskatoon in Canada and Nantes in Seattle. And so I did Saskatoon first and it was an amazing eye-opening experience to the point that when I first traveled there, I couldn't get a flight from France to Saskatoon in the middle of Saskatchewan. I could only travel to Montreal, which I did. And then in France, they said, oh, fine, but when you're in Montreal, you can book your flight, blah, blah, blah. It'll be no problem. Thankfully, I traveled a lot before that year of going away. So I wasn't scared of finding my way somewhere. But I remember going to a lot of different travel agents in Montreal to get my flight to Saskatoon. And the first question they'd ask every time was not when would you like to travel or where to, was why in the hell do you want to go to Saskatchewan? To the point that I became nervous. I was like, what have I signed up for?
Yeah.
And so it turned out that it was too expensive to fly. And so I got on a Greyhound coach.
Wow.
And it took 48 hours to reach destination.
I bet that was a journey and a half.
You know, it was incredible. It felt like an initiation in a way, because it was that gradual change of landscape from a full day of just pine forests and then moving on to the Great Plains and coming from Europe, where our landscape changes every couple of hours.
Yeah.
It's incredible. It was an amazing year. The people in Saskatchewan are... The people in Canada, as they have the reputation of being, are as friendly as we say. And the climate, we had like minus 20 was the average in winter. So the climate means people are really taking care of one another. I didn't have a car. I would walk everywhere and people would stop by the roadside and ask if I needed a ride anywhere. So it was a wonderful year. I got the chance to host a radio show in French and English. And I came back to France with a French Quebecois accent.
Really?
And a French Canadian accent in English. Yep.
Wow.
I loved it. And then I came back. I finished my degree, which was hard to do because I was very good at procrastinating and I would never get round to doing the writing work of the thesis we have to do. When you do a master's in France, you got a thesis to do for it. And I'd taken on a full-time teaching job. I was teaching languages already. So that was a painful year. And then I got the chance. Beyond that, it was going to be, okay, you got your degree, now you go and work. And someone had mentioned that it was a similar exchange program with Seattle. Or I had my on a two-year training in Brussels to become an interpreter for the European Commission.
Wow.
That's kind of where I was aiming. But I was seeing a Belgian boyfriend at the time who was into traveling a lot. And he said to me, he said, if you go to Seattle, I'll come and live with you. So that sealed it, Jules. I moved to Seattle, forgot all about the European Commission. And we had a great time in Seattle. It rained a lot, as people had warned me.
Yeah.
But it's a very vibrant city, and I loved it. Very different to Saskatchewan, and I'm glad of the order. Yeah. Things, you know, I think it's a good thing I did Saskatchewan before, because otherwise I would have found it dull, whereas I didn't. But it was also a really interesting cultural difference where the Canadians took me in completely, and I never felt alone. I never felt that I didn't know what to do with myself. You know, I spent all the different festivities with families that invited me in and all. In Seattle, it was more a lot of American excitement, you know. Oh, we've got to get together, we're going to have dinner. And then it wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
And so that was tougher. But I think it might have been more a big city thing than a trait of American people. I had the chance a few years later. I worked for a few years as a tour guide with American clients only. And I love them. I love them.
It's interesting. I studied in America for a year and I know what you mean. Sometimes it could be quite lonely, but then I was in the South. So I had a lot of hospitality and I spent I was taking in different holiday, like Thanksgiving and stuff at different people's houses. And yeah, I think it might have been a big city
probably
thing.
More,
maybe,
huh?
More, yeah,
I think.
But who knows? Oh, that's so. I want to go back to yoga now, if that's okay. Can you remember your first yoga class? Like, where does that sit in terms of France and then Seattle and Canada? Like, when did that start?
The timeline. What I didn't realize, because certain things you don't know until the years have gone by, when I left university in 93 was the last time I lived in France. It wasn't intentional, but that's what it became to be. And the Belgian boyfriend I was with at the time, we went on to travel the world, and we were in that lifestyle where you just move from country to country because you know where you can get a job next.
Wow.
You know, depending on seasonal work, bar work, blagged my way into being a chef in a Sydney cafe simply because I'd grown up in a restaurant and I had no idea how to cook a baked potato or an English breakfast because I'd grown up in an Italian restaurant. Anyway, and so it's when I'm in Australia that I come across yoga. So it's after Seattle, it's after months of traveling more around Southeast Asia. And by then I'd left Guido, we'd separated, and I was traveling with something called woofing, willing workers on organic farms.
Okay, I'm glad you explained that. I've not heard of that before.
It's amazing. It gave me a very alternative experience of Australia. So I was going from farm to farm, or a lot of people who were living off grid. And so there was a place I ended up in, and one of the guys who was staying there, they referred to as Yogi Bear, and I pestered him to teach me yoga.
Wow.
And the fact that he was incredibly handsome was definitely part of the motivation on my part.
Oh, I'm glad you've been honest about that. That's good.
Oh, Jesus. You know. So, yeah, that was my introduction to yoga, and I loved it right away. I'd been told since the age of 18 that yoga would be good for me because of I've got a fusion of the spine, a fusion of C1, C2 from birth. And so that leads to a pattern of pain and imbalance in my body. And so I'd been told right from around 18, 20 by different osteopaths that I should take up yoga. And I was like, you know, oh, no, boring, don't want to do this. And then I remember the first session with Travis, who was doing Ashtanga yoga. It killed me. And I was like, ooh, I like it. I want to do this again.
So you spent later your time doing your TT in Australia. Is that why you went there? Because it's such a long way away. When I read that about you, I thought, why Australia? I wasn't sure of the link. So just how did that come about? How did it jump from being a student of yoga to deciding you wanted to do your teacher training?
You're right. And there are a few years in between, because I meet Travis and I am introduced to yoga in 95, and I don't turn to a teacher training till 2000. And in between, it's a lot more of that kind of wanderlust lifestyle, you know, being from country to country, and working as a tour guide in those few years. But what was happening was that, so interestingly, Jules, between 95 and 2000, I do not attend people's classes. When I left Australia the first time in June 95, Travis gave me a copy of Iyengar's Light on Yoga. And he said, that's it. That's all you need. And so I didn't know any better. I believed him. And that's what I used. Yeah. And I would just make up my own thing. Little did I know, because you can imagine my level when I joined the teacher training. It was just shocking. But what happened was, I'd always been interested in self-development and psychology. And that's what I started seeing in yoga, that, oh, there was an element to this that also there was a crisscross with what I'd learned in spirituality, self-development, psychology that I could connect with in yoga. And between 95 and 2000, I went back to Australia a few times, and I went back to a very special place where we were working with street kids. And the key moment was meeting, I used to go and do the yoga for myself to take care of myself, because the work with the young street kids, most of them with drug and alcohol addiction already, was tough. And they were like, come on, we want to do yoga with you. Come on, Freddie. I was like, no, that's my space. And then I gave in one day. And at the end of the session, one of the girls, she was about 17, 18 at the time, and she'd had a pretty horrendous story of abuse and addiction. And she sat up at the end of the class and she said, wow, that was better than a hit of heroin.
Wow.
Yep. And that did it, Jules. That was the turning point for me, because where I'd been interested in turning, retraining in counseling or something like this, in that moment, what I felt was that in the process of a yoga practice, something else could happen that really took care of those needs without needing it to be a spoken therapy.
Yeah.
And so I went back to Europe and I did more things, blah, blah, blah. But then that little voice was there in the back of my mind. When are you going to do this yoga thing? And so when I looked for it, I decided on my first visit to Australia, it was the place where I wanted to spend the rest of my life. So when it came to retraining, I was working in pubs in London, making a lot of money and living the pub life. I knew that I couldn't teach training in London whilst working in a pub. It wasn't going to happen.
No.
So I needed to
get away,
take myself and fully focus on it. So there was a 9 month course, full-time 9 month teacher training in Byron Bay. And for anyone who's been to Byron Bay, it's like the moment I saw the address, I was like, this is where I'm going.
Wow.
Yeah. So that sealed it.
So how was, aside from your training, of course, what was your favorite experience when you were there? Would you say it was that moment with the kids or something else?
That place. I had until 2008, I had dreams that one day I would own that place. It was 2 hours out of Melbourne in the mountains and the forest. And it was a foster home for street kids. It was a refuge for native animals. It was an education center, a pioneer education center for school children, a youth hostel, bed and breakfast, and a place that worked with volunteers. And it was run by one incredible single older lady, Brownwin, who did the whole thing. And the time I spent there, even though very tough in a lot of ways on a human level, emotional level, and work-wise, it felt like this is where I wanted to be. And the memories of feeding my baby wallabies and wombats, you know, giving the baby bottle to the little baby wallaby who curls up in your lap. And then I used to walk around with them, like, you know, they'd jump in my lap and I would put a sheet. I would tuck it into my trousers and they'd jump in my lap and I would tuck it up and I'd walk around with my wallaby. You know, like, how could I? Yeah, that is probably the place. And I say it till 2008, it was a dream. And very sadly, in 2008, it was all completely destroyed by a fire.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we had 63 acres of land there. It was a huge place. It's gone.
What happened to the lady?
She left and she ended up living. She was pretty old already. Well, not pretty old. She was in her 70s when I was there.
Right.
So come 95, 97, I was there. 2008, I don't know what that makes her, but she'd moved to Tasmania. Okay. A few years before she'd sold and moved to Tasmania.
Blimey. Wow. So you left Australia. I guess that wallaby like around in your tucked up, carried around all day. You then went on to study pregnancy and postnatal yoga. See, my link's a bit weak there. I know it is, but I like it. So can you
I had a real baby in the meantime.
Oh, did you? Yeah, that makes sense. So can you tell me a bit more about those trainings and what you got from that?
So I was very blessed to do my teacher, pregnancy teacher training with Françoise Barbiera Friedman. She's right. The founder of the Birthlight Trust, a lovely French lady, and the trust was based in Cambridge. And on the training, I think we had Uma, who came for a day as well, Uma Dismortuli. And I can't quite remember, Jules, why I decided that I wanted to do the pregnancy teacher training.
You say you had, when did you have your baby?
It was about 3-4 years after I'd had my niece.
Mm.
So for a lot of women, it happens around the time of pregnancy. But what it did for me was it was very healing in the sense that my niece was born by C-section after 5 days in hospital, and she was 2 weeks late. It was miles away from the home birth pool that I dreamed of. And so doing the training with Françoise, I trained in both the pregnancy and the postnatal modules. And I loved those few years of teaching pregnancy yoga and postnatal yoga. And every woman who had a gentle birth or a more mindful birth that I had a chance to talk to afterwards, it felt like each one was helping heal a little bit my own story. So it's something, and I don't necessarily teach it actively anymore, but whenever someone around me is pregnant, I absolutely love guiding them, doing the birth preparation workshops with them and everything. And the postnatal is almost more important to me than the pregnancy classes. I think after having a child, and particularly if there are already other siblings, a woman's needs can really come last. And the postnatal class, I would set it up as a course. People have to sign up for 6 weeks at a time. And you come to class with the baby, but the focus is on you as the mom. I really enjoyed creating a time and a space that was about nurturing the new mom so that she felt supported and she could go back and enjoy being a mom again, you know, rather than maybe feeling exhausted and lost and she doesn't know who she is anymore.
Yeah, so there's already a bit of a theme, Freddie, about I feel you making sure that people can access yoga, like people, that it's for everybody, for new mums, for kids who, you know, need that, maybe they've had a bad childhood and stuff like that. And there's a lot of talk at the moment about the portrayal of Instagram yoga, where it's people, I mean, I've been guilty of it, although mine aren't fantastic, but, you know, doing poses and that's all that it's about, trying to look skinny as you can. Like, what have you got a view on that kind of portrayal and I know you have a view, just share your view.
Is it are we gonna get a beep?
Yeah, I do have, I can edit it out. I can get the scissors out, no problem.
Okay so I'm gonna take it back to myself and be a bit kinder than I might have been a minute ago. When I first went to Australia to train as a yoga teacher, it was a time where Madonna had got into Ashtanga. Do you remember? With her album Ray of Light, and yeah, she was chanting the Ashtanga chant and everything. And I went to Australia and I said to my housemates in London, I want shoulders like Madonna.
I mean, didn't we all? So,
and I got them. Yeah.
Hey.
I got them with the year of Ashtanga, no problem. So what I mean by this here, how do I link this to Instagram? If whatever is portrayed on Instagram as yoga ends up being a point of entry for someone into what I see as an incredible tool for self-care and self-development, then great.
Yeah.
From that perspective, fantastic. But I give Instagram, I don't look at any Instagram-related yoga whatsoever, because what I've seen has really shocked me. And in that respect, I find it a lot easier to have nothing to do with it. I think it feeds right into body dysmorphia, and that's not something we need more of in our society. And I,
I think it depends who you follow, doesn't it? If you probably looking at those images, it's just that's going to be what comes up all the time.
But the tool by itself, because it's a photography-based tool, is, of course, given us just the shallowest insight into yoga we could ever get. And then it becomes more about contortion than anything else, because it's boring to look at someone who goes within, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's nothing to see.
So tell me, Freddie, where did you come across adaptive yoga? Can you explain what adaptive yoga means?
So adaptive yoga is a yoga approach that is aimed or open to anyone living with mobility disability. But we go beyond mobility disability. So disabilities, plural, loss, trauma. So when you link it to the notion of loss, disconnect, trauma, then we see that it's not just addressing, well, I know how to teach someone in a wheelchair or someone who's an amputee, but we're addressing the whole of the person. How did I come across adaptive yoga from that angle? It's quite a narrow angle, and I'm really aware of how we're hearing a lot more about accessible yoga, and that's that's a slightly different.
Explain that difference, because I was a bit, you know, I don't.
So, and I could be wrong. For me, adaptive yoga connects directly to Matthew Sanford. Yoga teacher in the States, in Minneapolis, who himself has been disabled since the age of 13. So Matthew came to yoga as a wheelchair user in his early 20s. And from his personal experience, he decided that he had something to share. And he became a yoga teacher himself and started over time, started training able-bodied yoga teachers into adaptive yoga, into what became to be known as adaptive yoga. And I think in the last few years, we see something else start being used more, which is called accessible yoga. And for me, one of the key people when I think of accessible yoga at this point is Jivana Heyman, who's based in California. And Jivana worked with Matthew at some point. Like, he trained with Matthew and certainly gathered the tools that are around adaptive yoga. But I think Jivana's we could say yoga mission is wider, bigger, in the sense that from his own story, he opens it up to the gay and lesbian GBLT community. And from there, we come into looking at yoga for larger bodies, yoga for ethnic minorities, yoga for people with disabilities, yoga for this and that and that. So when I think of the two, accessible yoga for me means yoga for absolutely every single human being. When I look at adaptive yoga, it feels like it's a narrower scope or a narrower specialty, primarily working with people living with disability.
Thank you for clarifying that, based on your opinion, but that's good enough for me. I'm glad to have the understanding a bit more now. So what was so special about the training that you did with Matthew in the US? A big question.
Big question, because he's quite a man. Many levels. So to help get the picture a bit clearer. When I trained in Australia, I trained in Iyengar / Ashtanga. At the time, we were allowed to call it an Iyengar and Ashtanga teach training. And the style of yoga that I learned was full-on boot camp yoga, I think of it quite a lot. Then it's years later, so it's 2000. I didn't meet Matthew till 2011. And it was a simple chance events that came together that led me to do a workshop with Matthew in London when he was still coming regularly to train in London. And what I felt right away, Jules, was I felt in the presence of someone who was really authentic.
Yeah.
And his level of authenticity in class, what I mean by this is I felt in the presence of someone who could weave the personal in with the yoga teachings. Someone who wasn't in the room giving the impression of being this all-knowing, perfect being, but was there saying, I am broken, I am flawed, I am human, and I know things about yoga and I can kick your ass with it. Yeah, like Matthew's got this beautiful, incredible way of blending in humor and knowledge, and you never feel like you're inadequate. And I felt inadequate in plenty in my yoga journey because I'm not a naturally bendy person. And so I would say that was the first total breaking of wherever I was at in my yoga story.
Yeah.
The second aspect of it was realizing that, ooh, this was actually definitely a specialist learning, and that I knew nothing about doing movement with people living with disability, and that there were a lot of safety aspects that needed to be understood, respected, and in order for participants to safely practice. And when I first met Matthew, like within the first 5 minutes of being in an adaptive class with him in London, I knew that I wanted to train with him. I knew that I was out of my depth and I couldn't just start an adaptive class and go and learn at some point, okay? And so I did my best to convince Matthew to bring a teacher training to the UK. And he laughed and he said, you're crazy, never. Oh, okay. And so I said, okay, I'm going to come to you. And he said, well, that's even more crazy. But a few months later, I managed to travel to the States and train with him. And the reason he'd said, we can't do this in the UK was, I can come to the UK, but it's my students that are really going to teach you. And now that we're like 8-9 years down the line and we've started doing teacher trainings here in the UK, I can now really see why he said that. So you take yourself to the States, you do the teacher training. It's a 3-day course for level one. And almost all of the time is shared with adaptive students in the room who share their stories, but also it's a hands-on learning.
Right. Yeah,
we're directly teaching people living with disability. And they teach us about yoga way more than I'd ever seen before. Yeah. So, and so what I'm saying is completely vague and abstract, but the heart of the approach with Matthew Sanford is to look at what are the universal principles of yoga. Meaning what is left behind when maybe your arm can't lift up, okay? And so it's a bit like he puts it upside down. For us able-bodied practitioners or teachers, we tend to start in with a very physical practice, often a very dynamic practice that gets us hooked in and we feel good and feel strong. We get the Madonna shoulders, wah, wah, wah. This is cliche. There are many points of entry that are completely different from this. But still, I think for most of us, we're coming in and we're feeding physical sensations. Yeah. And we're doing so through a huge range of yoga poses. And then with adaptive yoga, what we're doing is we're going in, and it's like looking for a different radio channel. So you're saying to someone, what's the inner sensation of balance? What's the inner sensation of spaciousness or of feeling grounded? Yeah. Mm. And then you from that within your own body, as a teacher, from knowing that sensation in my own body, I'm going to find ways to modify our classical asana poses in a way that someone who is in a wheelchair can do, or someone who hasn't got a right arm can do, or someone with a stroke can join in. Okay. But it's, for me, it completely revolutionized everything I've done up till then, which was like some 10, 12 years of yoga. It helped me stop injuring myself, because it really got me to pay attention. And it took me away from achieving anything in yoga.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of us might relate to that. Like, I don't give a monkey's backside about whether I can put my head on my legs in a forward bend or not.
Mm-hmm.
But I did spend years hurting my back trying to get there. So I'm so glad to be done with that thing. But it really takes the practice within into an external expression. So from there, the limits are your creativity.
Mm.
Beautiful.
And what, in your view, is the main thing that prevents people with restrictions, illness, injury, disability from practicing yoga?
I would say, and it's changing fast, and I am so happy about that, because when I came back from training with Matthew in the States, it was April 2012, and I felt so incredibly alone with what I'd learned. So the key thing I would say is information. Yeah, like what we're doing now, spending time together in the yoga community or in the community of people living with disability, for instance, sharing information about the very fact that it even exists. Yeah, a lot of yoga studios still, or studio owners, may not know that adaptive yoga is an option. So that would be one. And then two, well, then it's amongst us community of yoga teachers, learning the skills, yeah, teacher training. Mm. And in that way, it's great. Three of us, Joe, Suzanne and I, went and trained with Matthew in 2018, and we're now qualified to share those trainings in Europe that can be left aside for now. So I think those two things are key. Then it's a willingness on our part as a teaching community to do what it's going to take to make it available and accessible. Yeah. The first hurdle I came across after I trained with Matthew, and I was still teaching in London at the time, the first hurdle I came across, Jules, was the main London yoga studios that I approached. One in particular made it very clear that they didn't have the money, that adaptive yoga was not going to make money.
Okay. So not that they didn't have the money, it wasn't going to make the money for them, it wasn't going to bring the people.
It wasn't going to make money. So if I could do the marketing and if I could find the people, then they'd put on a class.
Right.
So thankfully, I was already working for the Westway Trust, and by their nature being a trust, when I asked them, they decided, yeah, we were going to do that. And I taught the class at the Westway for 7 years. I passed it on to a very good friend and great teacher a couple of years ago. And that was an amazing opportunity and learning experience and a chance to put adaptive yoga on the map. So I really think, Jules, it's, and it's not always a possibility, because for all of us who've chosen yoga as a profession, we also need to respect that we need to make a living. Yeah. So it's the same for a yoga studio owner. Yeah, I fully respect that they still need to get enough money coming in per class. So we've got a financial hurdle. We've got also the hurdle of what does it mean to have an accessible space? And that's not always possible. There's a fantastic yoga studio, Jignesh, his last name escapes me right now, who's been doing yoga. He lives with polio, wheelchair user. Mm-hmm. He's a basketball player for the GB wheelchair basketball team. Mm-hmm. And he decided he really wanted to do yoga. And he had found a Bikram or a hot yoga studio in Leicester where he lives on the first floor. And Jignesh used to crawl, yeah, on his arms to go up to the studio. That's how keen he was. And he's had a great yoga practice for years now. But that's the level of inaccessibility of our community. Mm. So I think these are the things to do as a community of teachers and studio owners. Let's get around the table together and chat. How do we make it accessible with funding for the classes? There's huge amount of funding available with accessibility. I find it so far it's been easier to take adaptive yoga where people living with disabilities already gather.
And right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely possible for any studio teacher to get their own class going.
Yeah, because I was listening to, just going back to the London studios for a moment, I did listen to the podcast you did last year with Movement for Modern Life. And I was really interested when you talked with the host about the London studios. And like you said, sometimes the buildings just can't be adapted. Mm-hmm. And for me, like I used to go down to London and treat myself before I moved far, far north in Northumberland. I lived in Bedfordshire, so it's a quick hop on the train, an hour into London, and I was at the pick of the studio. So I would go and treat myself, have a nice class, go to a nice workshop. But I felt also quite uncomfortable sometimes, intimidated. You know, people handstanding in the studio before the workshop even started. And it just, I had to really have a word with myself because I felt I was being put off. My confidence was being knocked. And it was basically, ultimately, it was spoiling my experience. I was going down for a treat, but I was the only one who was feeling, you know, a lack of confidence, a bit knocked, and no one else was bothered. I was bothered and it was affecting my experience. So I really had to have a word with myself. And now it's not the studio. I don't see that they would be at fault. That's purely on me. So I had to change my feelings and my attitude that forced myself to be more comfortable. But I'm a teacher. So for someone able-bodied or not to come into that environment, I think it's going to be so hard for a London studio to get over that. What do you think about that?
So I think you're raising a really good question here. And I think you so beautifully did what as yoga teachers were very good at, which is to go, well, the blame is going to be with me. Yeah. And yeah. Well done for that, Jules. This is where I'm French. I go, yeah, no. The blame is not just with you, the individual. Yeah, there's a lot of work we can do about ourselves to go somewhere where it feels challenging or feeling inadequate and to kind of tune within and go, okay, what is going on in my own story here right now that's triggering me so much?
Yeah.
And that's a great thing to do. But we're reacting to something that is still going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I certainly, and Jesus Christ, it really bugged me and moved me deeply when the first couple of times that I invited my London adaptive students to join Matthew's trainings at the London Big Studio when he was coming to visit, Jesus Christ, what a slap it was for them. Yeah. They felt so inadequate, they felt so out of place, they felt so triggered, so challenged. For the same reasons that you've described, Jules, they felt they didn't belong.
Wow.
And so, in a way, How am I going to say this and be kind? In a way, I think it's okay. What I mean by this is I think yoga is big enough. And who we are as a community of teachers is definitely big enough, rich enough to survive the culture shock in a way that happens with what may have become the more successful yoga studios. So what I know in my heart is that the community classes that were going on at the Westway, I taught at the Westway for almost 20 years, the Westway Sports Center. And way before I started adaptive yoga, my classes were incredibly multicultural, and that's how it was. And some people would come in on crutches because different range of movement that they were living with. And as you say, it was people of all sizes, all ages, all cultural and racial backgrounds. Because that's who we are. That's part of why I love living in the UK. That's who we are as a society. Then within that society, there are pockets that are like the London yoga studios is the same to the culture of the UK as Eton private schools. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
There are elite places. But you know what I feel? What this is going a bit bigger than subject, but ultimately, the heart of yoga is not there. The heart and soul of yoga doesn't live where Lululemon thrives.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what's really important. And I know because I partook in one of the conferences. It was another term they'd used, but Tri Yoga invited me a few years ago to have to be part of a panel of teachers to discuss how do we make studios more inclusive. I know they're aware of it. I know they're working on it. They will have some degree of success with it. It may not be, you know, a complete success story because community is not something you can artificially create with marketing formulas.
Mm-hmm.
Community happens because of you and I and all the other teachers who meet their students, know their name, know what's going on for them, and work with them from that.
Yes, you're so right. That's just illuminating. I just love that. Like you're right, because I started teaching in local village halls, leisure centres, and although yes, audience where I was in Bedfordshire predominantly white, so there's that. But they were all ages, sizes, men, women. Different health issues, like you say, struggling with mobility, amputees. So it was actually pretty diverse as an audience for yoga. I mean, I didn't really think about it. Because racially it was white, that almost blinded me to the fact that it is actually diverse in a lot of other ways. But yeah, you're right. It's in the heart of the community, and a lot of the teachers that I speak to and the podcast that are up and down the country have these students in the classes, don't they?
Absolutely, yeah. Inverted commas, that's where the real yoga is happening. It's not on Instagram and it's not on the big studios. The value of the big studios, I really think, is that they're able to draw international teachers in and give us the exposure to the teachings of people, you know, who might have become the big teachers we all want to go to.
Yeah.
But right. the everyday yoga is something completely different.
That's a lot of food for thought. That's great. So in your opinion, how can we conscious, white, middle-aged, able-bodied women champion more diversity in yoga? Is it just a case of doing what we're doing, getting out there in the village halls, well, when we're allowed to get in village halls again? But is it that, just making sure we're visible in our local communities?
It's a useful question, and hopefully I don't answer with cliches, because I would hate for anyone to feel left out or offended. I think in the same way that in 2011, I'd never heard of adaptive yoga. I didn't know it existed. And yet I'd been doing yoga since 95. I think it comes again back down to communication and information and sharing knowledge. So that is one way, knowing that there, you know, I think we're better as a yoga community nowadays at knowing that there are options such as larger body yoga classes or LGBT yoga classes or a class for people with MS or a class for people with cancer and so on and so on. And I really believe in, I think, yeah, I'll stick with it. I really believe that the majority of us yoga teachers are led by our hearts, okay? Or heart, we've got one each. Or maybe like, you know, the Hindu goddess with eight hands, we've got multiple hearts once we become a yoga teacher. But I think in that way, whatever we're going to resonate with is where we're going to take the yoga. So someone is going to have a real affinity to working with children. Someone else is going to want to take it into prison. Someone else is going to want to work with their local care home because their parent is now in a care home and they feel and they saw the need for it. I really think it's a grassroots evolution that's going to take yoga to all the pockets where at the moment the idea of doing yoga is completely alien. And I really hope that as a yoga community, we stop beating ourselves up for what we're not doing. Because I think all the people that I meet that have chosen to be yoga teachers, I meet incredibly beautiful people, giving, generous, creative, very often have made financial choices that mean they're not earning much compared to the kind of career they could have had in the corporate world.
Yeah.
And yet we tend to put ourselves down so much.
Yeah.
We're doing something special and we're doing it in already a very wide range of ways, very multicultural. And that's the beauty and the value of it. And so let's trust in who we are. And let's carry on what I love about, you know, being a yoga teacher in the UK. Let's carry on that beautiful spirit of cooperation. You know, you and I are complete strangers and we meet today. and I can feel that already. What do we want? Well, how can we do this better together?
Yeah.
You know, like it doesn't feel like a world of competition.
No.
There is some, yeah, blah, blah, blah. But this is special. And I think we really need to treasure how and why it is special and carry on reaching out to one another and saying, can we build this to be even better?
I think something you touched on as well, you said about community and making sure people feel welcomed and we know their name. And I think that's something that in the local classes and people that you've built up a relationship with, that's not, you know, the London studios are not going to have that, are they? It's because ultimately, from a business perspective, like you say, we've all got to make money and we want to make money. I still want to, I'll say I know my students' names. I want them to come back every week. I want them to feel welcomed and encouraged. And I suppose, yeah, we have to focus on that, what differentiates us as well, don't we?
Yeah, I think in that respect, the first teacher who had a very strong influence on who I've become is an Australian teacher, Iyengar teacher, Glenn Sarasoli. And when you get to the end of your teacher training and you feel like you know nothing and you're never going to be able to do this. So I remember one of those conversations with Glenn where I was like, how do I do it? And he said to me, watch, like just use your eyes all the time and ask questions. And so, and what he was saying, because I was already interested in the therapy aspect of yoga, yeah? And what he was saying was, well, try different things and then get feedback from people and then learn. If they say no, then okay, this doesn't work and you try something else, okay? So this might seem, what I've just said might seem far from your question, but what I mean by this can only happen if you know your student. you know? So this is what I found for me very quickly, Jules, is that I didn't teach in the big London studios when I first started. I started in 2001, but I was teaching in all the London clubs at the time, and Holmes Place were less of a community club than some of the other places where I was teaching. And it was interesting. There was such a contrast between the Holmes Place students who would come to class, and the vibe you described of going to the big London studios, you know, everyone in their own little bubble of seclusion and doing fancy poses. It was that vibe. And then I'd come in and I'd be like, hey, so what's your name? And then, but what's going on with your knee? And what's, you know, I wanted to know. And I could see that there was a sense of, are we going to have to talk? Am I going to have to be seen? And so this is who I am. Yeah, this is who I am as a teacher. This is why I teach, because otherwise I would feel incredibly lonely walking into the class and having 40 people in front of me and walking out not knowing a single name and not having given personal instructions. Mm. I teach. I take that very seriously. I've always been in education. I like to share knowledge, share, not impose. So there's an exchange. Mm. It's a discussion. It's, I think I see this and that going on. And then, you know, you tell me, like, you should hear my classes. There's a bit of chit chat going on in there because we're getting the feedback and we learn from one another. And so I think the level at which a class has a personal element is essential. Even this year, more than ever. Yeah. Mm. Feeling invisible is hurtful. Yeah. We can choose to make ourselves invisible. That's different. But for a lot of us, the feeling seen in a class, heard, feeling that you're a part of it, that's already a big part of the exchange that happens in a yoga class.
I was going to ask, are you teaching online at the moment? You are.
Yeah, all my classes are online.
So I saw that you normally hold classes at Stoke Mandeville, like the Paralympics stadium. You said about taking adaptive yoga to where there would be a population of those with disabilities. Yes. Already. How did that come about?
So for anyone who doesn't know Stoke Mandeville, it's a tiny little place next to Aylesbury in Buckinghamshire. And Stoke Mandeville is the birthplace of the Paralympics. And it's also where there's a main hospital for spinal cord injuries and rehab hospital. So it's a place where a lot of people who live with disability end up living because services, facilities are available right there. And I'm very fortunate. It's only a 40-minute drive from home. Mm. And by chance, at my local gym, the studio coordinator was then given the job to manage Stoke Mandeville. Ah. And he knew that I was doing adaptive yoga.
Right.
And he took on the job at the Stoke Mandeville Stadium, which is a large health club. He took on the job and he got in touch with me very quickly. And he said, oh, Freddie, I can't believe it. We've got over 3,000 members. About 300 of them are living with disabilities. We haven't got a single studio class aimed at them. And so that was an incredible blessing. It was like, are you interested? I'm like, am I interested? Of course I'm interested. And so it's one thing that I feel really sad about, Jules, is that we've not been able to carry on the class at all.
Right.
Since the first lockdown, I'm aware some classes are going on online with, they've got a class running with a lady based in Bristol, Nina, her last name escapes me. And I'm really glad Nina is paraplegic. I'm glad she's been able to do some online classes with them. But online, teaching adaptive yoga online is super hard.
Mm.
Because, well, as adaptive teachers, we'd all have a different relationship to this. For me, a lot of what I share in teaching adaptive yoga is passed on through touch.
Yeah.
And so that's not an option currently. And that breaks my heart because through touch, not an adjustment, but reference, we can reveal the sensation we're guiding someone towards. And so I've spent time with Matthew Sanford in some of his trainings online this year because they're really busy trying to overcome that obstacle over in the States as a team as well. And we're struggling. How do you, you know, how do you put your hand at the back of the heart? Like when you put your hand at the back of someone's heart and invite them to feel and to melt into the sensation of receiving support. How do you do that over Zoom?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the Zoom hurdle.
Yeah, that is a hurdle.
But it's, but it won't last.
No, no. And you've said before, I've seen you've written that your work can be really moving. And I, just from what you said then, I could see that it would be. Can you give us some examples, maybe one example of an experience you've had when you've been teaching adaptive yoga?
So here I'm going to put it back to front and maybe it'll make more sense. I have a lot of stories I could share with you, but if I were to listen to a podcast and I heard someone share my story of inverted comma brokenness, in the sense that I strongly believe we're all broken and it's not always visible. But if someone shared my story, you know, and that the reaction of the audience was like, oh, gasp and kind of feel sorry for me and everything, I'd be pissed off. So in that way, that side of things, I'm definitely not going to share. Like when we're in the yoga room together in adaptive class, I'm one of the gang. We're all in there with our different levels of brokenness. And so in a way, maybe it's because I come to that notion that we're all, as teachers and participants, whether it's an adaptive class or not, I think, we're all in there with our different levels of brokenness. Then it levels out the playing field. And so so that's part of why it moves me so much, Jules, is that in other people's stories, I recognize my own. And then it makes me cry, but it helps me heal as well. So to give more meat to your question without feeling that I'm betraying any individual
no
story.
No confidence is broken.
One thing that has been completely different and a beautiful gift in the adaptive classes is that when I teach an adaptive class, you know, at the beginning of the class, I'm all settling in and, hey, so-and-so and Jill, how are you doing? And you, John, and blah, blah, blah. And then the class goes a bit quiet. And usually in my adaptive classes, there's someone who's going to say, and you, Freddie, how are you? And what I saw again and again is that that question was genuine. And that question wasn't going to put up with the bullshit of the whoops. I put on my teaching mask. Hi, I'm good. I'm fine, guys. Let's get on with it. And so it's been, and some people might disagree with that and think this isn't part of the role of the yoga teacher, and I'd be totally happy to have those disagreements because I think there's room for all of that. What teaching the different groups of adaptive yoga has given me is it's given me the chance to be more open about what goes on for me, the chance to, on the day where my heart is breaking because because I've had yet another love story that's gone wrong, I can tell my students and then we'll have a laugh and a cry together. Or I've been dealing with horrendous periods and for the last 6-7 years. And I remember a time where I really silently suffered in class because I'm in there for an hour And as the teacher, you're not supposed to leave the room, but you can feel that actually right now your clothes are stained and you need to leave the room, and I wouldn't. And what I learned from being with the adaptive students was that actually, how could I ask them, how could I supposedly guide them to tune in and move and live from a place of kindness to self if I wasn't giving it to myself? Yeah, so that's where I love it. That's where I get rocked to the deepest, because for me, teaching adaptive yoga has taken me right to the very heart of our shared humanity and to the exact polar opposite of what we see on Instagram and what we might see in the biggest studios, in the sense that, you know, I feel when I'm in the room with students in any class, I'm one of you. I know some stuff about yoga and you all know some stuff about yourselves, and now let's share things together. Yeah, so I really feel that level of authenticity and feeling as a teacher that it was okay for me to say, actually today I'm really struggling. That feels, I don't know, I'll share a story with you because it really struck me. And I think we're moving away from that, and I'm delighted. But I bumped, there's a lovely teacher where I live, she's retired now, Danielle. She was an Iyengar teacher for some 40 years. And I bumped into her at the supermarket one day, and I was sharing similar stories to what I've said to you about how I was dealing with very heavy period and really struggling in class, and slowly daring openly said to my group, today is not a good day and I might need to leave the room. And she's a beautiful French woman, and she just started smiling and going, oh, and moving with her hands, talking with her hands, going, Freddie, I am so happy to hear this. I'm so happy to hear our yoga culture is changing. And she told me of an example of when she was on the board of teachers who would do examinations to certify someone as an Iyengar teacher. And she said there was one instance where a lady who was taking the examination had lost her husband 3 days before.
Wow.
And the committee of teachers had met before to discuss her circumstances. And it had been agreed that nothing would be done different. Nothing would be done different to accommodate her circumstances.
Wow.
And that to me is incredibly violent. And that is, I cannot reconcile that with the notion of yoga. And I do not think that classical is not the word I want to use, but I do not think that the model that we took on board from the 20th century leading yoga gurus, be it Iyengar, be it Patabi Joyce, be it Krishnamacharya, you know, all the stories that have come out about the disguised abuse, that needs to stop. Yeah, and so in that way, I really rejoice to see who we are as a community of teachers nowadays, and how probably, I think because a lot of us are women, how there's a softer heart to what is being taught. Because I'm not sure that yoga needs to hurt to do the job.
Oh, no. Say no more. What you're saying. Say no more. Sometimes we push ourselves, don't we? But yeah,
oh, I did it very well, my darling, and I will do it at the drop of a hat, give me the chance. But it's definitely something I strive not to go there.
Yeah,
I don't think I need to.
So thank you for sharing that was really look, that was just lovely to hear you talk then. I want to understand now, a couple of years ago, you went back to learn how to teach teachers adaptive yoga. So you went back to learn with Matthew that. so that you can roll out teacher training across the UK and Europe. Can you share a bit more about the programme that you've developed and how that's going?
Sure. So that's been a real privilege. So in the last 10 years, three of us European-based teachers, I'm going to say she was known mainly as Jo Dauphin, but I think now is known more as Jo Mary, Suzanne Galfredi and myself, we found ourselves going to Matthew's trainings again and again, and then we all did the trips to the States to become qualified yoga teachers, and we worked together here in the UK, and we came to a point where we felt that we so wanted teacher training to be available in Europe. And so we asked Matthew and we asked for permission to share his teachings in Europe. And we all agreed that actually the best way to do it was to be trained directly by him. So he did something, it's a one-off. He basically took us in April 2018. We went there as three teachers and Louise Edwards, who's an adaptive student who has been doing a lot of work to support access for adaptive students to yoga. I can tell you a bit more about that in a moment. So the four of us went to the States and we participated in a week-long teacher training. And basically, Matthew took the time to give us his teacher training content. That's what he's done. So. It's not something I have developed. It's something that has been shared with the three of us. We've since split to work separately, but we're working from that same root content, if you want. And so we had the chance in 2019 to, maybe 2018, I can't quite remember, to run teacher trainings in Italy, where Suzanne was based, and over here in Stoke Mandeville. So it was fantastic. The reason it became possible as opposed to traveling to the States was for the very explanation Matthew had given me when I said, can you teach here? And he was like, no, you need to come to my students to know how to do yoga. So it's the same. Starting to have a student base here in the UK, in Stoke Mandeville, of regular adaptive students who know what's going on, who know the inner sensation of expansion. And then when they're in the room with a group of teacher trainees and are receiving an assist to help them feel expansion, if the teacher is off, they're going to be able to tell them.
Mm.
Yeah, and that's a key, that's a key ingredient to being able to share this program over here in Europe. So yeah, so that's where we're at right now. It's on hold.
Yeah, I was going to say
on pause. Yeah, of course, because we need to be able to touch.
Mm-hmm.
But that's okay. It will come again. And so we've got, I'm going to say I, because we're not necessarily doing it together anymore. But I've got different stages for it. So the first one is Introduction to the Principles of Adaptive Yoga, and that's a 1 day or 2 day training, depending on, you know, if a yoga studio has availability for 1 day or 2 days. But introductions to the principles of adaptive yoga is very much aimed at people who don't necessarily want to specialize in working with students with disability, but are aware that in their everyday classes, they're getting a greater range of needs.
Yeah.
You know, someone comes in and they've had a hip replacement and so has really damaged their knee at a skiing accident, and so and so is living with cancer, and so on. Yeah, we're all seeing this in our classes, and in our own journey as teachers, Jules, we're getting older, and we're going to need to modify our practice.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really a teacher training that helps people begin to understand the principles behind how do you lean on classical yoga to make it adaptable to endless possibilities. Yeah. Mm. And so that's the intro. And then there's a 3 day actual teacher training, level one adaptive yoga, opening yoga to everyone. And then there's the level two for people who've already done the first one, where we go deeper into the work.
So is that the plan to start rolling that out again when you're able to?
I'd love to, my darling. it might take a bit of time in the sense that it will take gathering an adaptive community again.
Yeah.
And so what I've had the chance to see in the last couple of years, taking Introduction to the Principles of Adaptive Yoga to any studio, any group of teachers anywhere in France. Oh, I said France. I'm in the UK, but yeah, I'll take it to France as well. Anywhere in Europe is easy. That's dead easy because it doesn't rely on the participation of adaptive students.
Yeah.
Doing the level one and level two teacher training courses will most likely mean you guys coming to where we have a community of adaptive students.
Yeah. That makes sense though, right? Makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a beautiful, beautiful, special weekend to be in the room with adaptive students and to learn through their stories.
Yeah, and you've got, I guess you have to get the buy-in of that community. Have you ever had, I guess you've had no obstacles as far as that goes?
No.
Good. So what are you most proud of so far, Freddie, overall?
Oh, I don't know, Jules, because I probably don't really think. Oh, Jesus Christ, I don't think in terms of being proud. What am I happiest about?
Yeah, you can catch it in a different way. With, yes.
Yeah. Having the beautiful daughter that I have, who's functional, creative, well adjusted to the society we live in and so on.
Nice.
And me being able to still be living from passion.
Mm. Yes, that is a good achievement. If you weren't a yoga teacher, what would you be?
Oh, a million things. Like there's a lot of different things. There's a good chance there would be an educational aspect to it because I love sharing knowledge, but also definitely more so with this year of slower life. And maybe because of reaching the menopause years, where I think that this menopause transition is really a chance to shift our creative energy.
Mm.
I'll be an artist, darling.
Very nice.
I'll say it as it is. I'm very creative, and that's something that's coming up a lot more.
Oh, good. Good. You're not the first person to say that. I've interviewed someone for the podcast very recently, and they've also getting their paints out and their easel out. So yeah, I think you're not on your own there. So that gets us now. Thank you for everything you shared. We're on to quickfire questions now. So just don't feel under pressure. Say what you feel. Late to bed or early to rise?
Oh, clearly late to bed.
Oddest thing in your handbag, if you still use a handbag.
Well, is it going to be odd to yoga teachers? Crystals?
I'm not commenting. who do you look up to?
The Dalai Lama.
What's your favourite film?
Ooh, there are a lot of them because I'm a real film buff, but I'm going to go with one that moves me to the deepest every time, The Notebook.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how cool are you?
Way cool, girl. 9. Or 12.
Mountainside or lakeside?
Neither. Can I have the rolling hills with a river, please?
Okay, riverside. Okay, you can have that. Tom Hanks or Leonardo DiCaprio?
Oh, Jesus Christ. Never Tom Hanks. Okay, Leo.
What's your star sign?
Libra.
Who would you swap lives with just for a day?
Oh, my God. I was going to say Trump. Oh, let's go for it because it's impossible to even imagine. So yeah, like if I were to swap lives, it would be to experience something completely insanely different.
Yeah.
And I will get the dose of insanity, that's for sure.
Yes. Countryside or city?
Country.
If you owned a yacht, what would you call it?
La Belle Échappée, The Beautiful Escape.
Oh, I'm glad you translated it. Thank you. What is at the top of your bucket list, Freddie?
I haven't got a bucket list. I've always lived from going after what I want. So oh, I don't need a bucket
that.
List.
I love that. Describe your baddest and brightest leggings.
I don't know. One of my favorite ones, they're gorgeous. There's a brand, and I don't know the name, but that's good because we don't need to do the advertising. There's an American brand that does gorgeous, cheap leggings, and they've got a gorgeous one with little Buddhas on the calves that I really like.
And where is your favorite place in the whole wide world?
Oh, in nature. Australia, still, yeah, the nature in Australia holds my heart and soul.
Oh, and what is your favorite yoga pose?
Down dog, as my students will tell you. Down dog forever.
Oh, well, that's the end of quick fire questions. You'll be relieved to know, under pressure.
Thank you.
So I'd like to ask you now, what is your favourite music or sound for savasana or shavasana when you're having relaxation at the end of class? If you've got any advice for a track or something that you recommend we listen to?
So I never use music in yoga. For myself, nor when I teach. I find it a distraction, and I like the going within experience. But at the same time, for anyone who gains from listening to music, my favorite artist in that genre would be Carrie Nash. He's got an album. It's got a beautiful lotus flower on it. Heart Meditation, I think it might have been called. And there's a track where it sounds, I used to play it here and there in class. Oh yeah, here it is. Heart Chakra Meditation number 2. It's called Coming Home. And I think the track that I love is Here and Now. And I felt like it was like Mongolian shepherds chasing me on the big open Mongolian plains, like on horseback.
Wow, that is so descriptive. I definitely need to. I'll find it. I'll get the information from you on. I'll put it on the episode notes. And that is, I'm going to visualize that now, being chased by. Well, I don't know if we want to be chased, but
but it was a very romantic chase.
Yeah,
Mongolian,
in a good way.
Mongolian shepherds on horseback.
Oh, lovely!
On the big open Mongolian plain.
Oh, I've got to listen to that now. So, thank you so much, Freddie, for chatting to me. I've loved having this conversation with you, and I hope the listeners enjoy listening to it as well. I'll just tell them they can contact you through your email address, which is fs@yogifreddie.com. And the Freddie, well, I'll spell the whole lot, fs@yogifreddie.com. That's how you're spelling Yogi Freddie. And then on Facebook is the same, Yogi Freddie, and they'll be able to find you on there. Thank you so much for this conversation,
Jules. I've loved every minute with you.
Thank you too
for your
time. Thank you.
Take good care.
You've been listening to That Yoga Woman's podcast with me, Jules Buchanan. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it, share it on social media, rate it, write a nice review, and subscribe to That Yoga Woman's podcast. Links and information can be found on the episode page in the podcast section of my website, www.thatyogawoman.com/podcast. If you'd like to show some support for the podcast, you can do that through PayPal. The donation link is www.paypal.me/thatyogawoman. The last thing I'll mention is my line of organic cotton yoga-inspired tops.
I designed a small range of vest tees and sweatshirts that are perfect to teach or do yoga in. Have a look online, check out my shop on my website, www.thatyogawoman.com/shop. Have a look around my store and make an order. See you soon.